Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. I'm Charlie Carter, and I'm here with Tim Little and Andy Stearns. Let's jump into the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
As we sip some coffee, let's talk about some sponsors. Thank you, Nikki Carr, BMM missionary in Romania, who brought us some beans. What was the name of it?
Snooze.
That's...
Well, it's the Snooze Blend. Day starters? I'm not sure, actually. The label's all in, well, not English, so...
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Romanian?
So it's a Brazilian-Ethiopian blend.
Oh.
Yeah, but it's a light roast.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Because there's that, there's a little bit of earthiness in it that's not as fruity. That makes, because I just had Brazilian this weekend. Yeah. Oh, man. It's good.
And we'll mention some of our other normal patrons here, Porchlight Coffee House, Brick House Coffee Co., and just for fun, I'm going to throw in Blue Cow, moving in storage.
Moving.
That's right. We're going to have some announcements here in a moment, and then here's what's in the rest of the episode. We're going to have some weekly wisdom from Andy. We're going to interact with a listener email who wants us to decide if her ideas of who we are, if we were in Lord of the Rings, like she picked characters for us, if we would agree with her or not. We're going to talk about that. And then we're going to do books and business. And Andy's being really sneaky about it, so we'll get to that in a little bit. And then the main topic of the episode, Tim is going to talk about Psalm 42 and Psalm 82.
45 and 82.
I was so close.
But it's basically the sons of God, you know, who are, what is a God? And yeah, so that.
Is it connected to the Unseen Realm discussion?
Yeah, Unseen Realm by Michael Heiser.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's have some announcements. First, when the week you're listening to this, also this same week, we are interviewing S.D. Smith, or Sam Smith, the author of the Green Ember series of books, which a collection of children's books about rabbits.
Rabbits with swords. They're so good.
I have started reading the first one so that I could converse about it in the interview we're about to do. But so you can be excited about that. And one of the ways that you can express your excitement would be to jaunt over to the Faith Bookstore or online and buy as many Sam Smith things as you possibly can.
There's quite a few of them now. He's coming out with some new series now, Mooses with Bazookas. Did you get into that one?
I did. We've gotten like a third of the way through. Uh-huh. It's pretty fun. It's just a goofball slapstick story.
Yeah.
It's hard to read to little kids.
Because they don't get the humor.
Well, but here's the thing is that's what I thought. It's hard to read to little kids. So we read through a third of it. And then we were driving around and I downloaded the sample on Audible for fun.
Uh-huh.
And they probably read like a 4-minute section that we had already read. And I explained the jokes and the kids were rolling in the car. So it was interesting. It was almost like educational, but it was, it's unique and fun and it's pretty exciting.
You can use it to teach your kids what humor is.
Yeah. Yeah. I really do. It's pretty fun. It's pretty fun.
It looks intriguing to me. And
So if you are like, hey, I want to get some Green Ember books, then mention that you heard us talk about it on the podcast and that you can have 25% off. We stock a lot of those titles, so pick them up. And I'll tell you, if you have multiple kids, get the hardcovers because we've had problems.
And I'm gonna use sign language with Tim. There's another interview we're going to do that also accompanies with a book.
Yeah, I got to order that one still.
Okay, so we're not going to mention it because it's not at the Faith Bookstore.
It'll be a surprise.
Yeah. Anyway, do we have any...
He talked about it last week.
It was a joke. It was the name of the title.
He's being sneaky.
Okay.
It's the name of the title.
So,
okay. I was surprised by the comment.
Oh, my goodness. So, what's great is maybe some of these people, since they're coming on our podcast, are going to listen to some of the recent episodes, in which case they're going to listen to this, and they're like, wow, why did we agree to that? Anyway, so any ministry or academic updates?
So I had a pretty busy week last week. I taught my Proverbs module, and then I had the American Academy of Religion is a conference. This was not really the upper Midwest region American Academy of Religion conference. So Upper Midwest would be Iowa, Minnesota, and whatever's in Canada north of us. So anyway, it was Friday, Saturday. It's actually into Sunday a little bit too, but this is the American Academy of Religion. So what is Christianity? How does Christianity connect to that?
Well, it's one of the religions.
It's one of the religions. Okay. So like there's like a Buddhist section and this one Buddhist guy was interacting in the session. So for like the first session that I went to was a roundtable on interreligious studies, subverting and expanding philosophy of religion. And one of the big issues in philosophy of religion is that we look at religions, the religions of the world, from a Western context. And of course, a Western context is a
Christendom. Christendom is the only game in town.
Exactly.
It's totally cultural. It's dominant.
We are then filtering all other religions from our own theological background, which would be Christianity. So the one guy gave a great illustration, which helped me a little bit, Buddhism, and how Buddhism, they're encouraging generosity, and how in Christianity, to be generous is the opposite of being selfish. So if you're selfish, then you're not being generous. But he's like, in Buddhism, that doesn't work, because to be generous will help you in the reincarnation. So there's not a conflict between generosity and selfishness, because to be generous is to be selfish, because you're going to have a better life in the reincarnation.
That almost shapes generosity into a different thing, because the motivation has to change.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, so it was interesting to attend, but that gives you an idea of the breadth of the American Academy of Religion. It's extremely broad. They had these interfaith gatherings where they went to the Islamic mosque and a Buddhist temple in town, evidently. I knew some of those were around, but anyway, so I attended a few sessions. I gave a presentation, and then Dr. Paul gave a presentation as well. So that's been going on this last weekend. This one... A student presented a paper on embracing pluralism, the biblical responsibility of interfaith work in inspiring social justice and peace. So, dude, arguing for pluralism, literally against
the Shema,
exclusivism. You know, so yeah. We are exclusivistic. The Christian faith is exclusive. It is the true faith. That's what we believe. And so how that's wrong. And of course, the person presenting it grew up an exclusivist.
Yeah,
and abandoned the faith. So basically, it was a pile of ex-evangelicals. In fact, one of the presenters had written a book. The title was Ex-Evangelicals. Ex-Evangelical.
Ex-Evangelical. That's the hashtag on Twitter.
Yeah, Ex-Evangelicals. And so I'll probably talk about that on a future episode.
Didn't she win a signed copy of that book?
Oh, yeah. And I asked her... She's like, "Do you want me to personalize this?" And I'm like, "Yeah, just personalize it to Tim." So to Tim, she signed it.
That's so awesome.
Ex-evangelicals. loving, living, and leaving the white evangelical church, or something like that is the subtitle. So anyway, there we go.
I have no ministry update. Well, I did speak at Alumni Chapel, I enjoyed that. It was good to see our seniors. And it's their first alumni chapel. They're going to graduate. This is one of my favorite times of year on Bible colleges is you're getting close to graduation and all the hard work of the students is about to pay off. And I love that. And so that was good. Yeah, that was pretty good. Didn't do any ministry updates this way. I didn't teach anything, but. Whoosh. All right. Insert whoosh, I think. For this week's weekly wisdom, we're going to talk about when wisdom will laugh at you. So I'm going to read a couple of verses here and just take a quick thought for you to think about. In Proverbs chapter 1, wisdom is personified in verse 20 and following as this person who's calling out to you in these various places. So verse 20 following says, "Wisdom cries aloud in the street, in the markets she raises her voice. At the head of the noisy street she cries out. At the entrance of the city gates she speaks. How long, O simple ones, will you love being simple? How long will scoffers delight in their scoffing and fools hate knowledge? If you would turn at my rebuke, behold, I would pour out my spirit on you, and I will make my words known to you. But because I have called and you have refused to listen, and I have stretched out my hand and no one has listened, because you have ignored all my counsel and would have none of my reproof," and then verse 26 is what we want to focus on, I also will laugh at your calamity and mock you when terror strikes you. I think the first time I read this, I thought it was odd that God, like the good God element in the passage, is going to mock, make fun of, and laugh at the misfortune of others. Until I thought about it, it's not really misfortune. And so, listener, what's going on here is it's presenting a picture of people who have been given biblical truth or wisdom, but have not heeded it. And then because they have not heeded it, when things fall apart, wisdom laughs. And I still thought that was kind of mean until I realized, as I'd gone through it myself, that sometimes you go through a situation and you immediately regret what you've done. And all the times you were given advice not to do that come flowing back to your mind, and it's almost like they're mocking you. So, weekly wisdom this week. Is there instruction from God's word or advice from wise counsel that you've been given that you're not heeding? Heed it. You wouldn't want to be mocked.
Whoosh. Let's move to, I'm just going to read the subject line of the email.
Oh, yeah.
Character analysis. Hello, Thinklings. Thank you very much for your podcast that shares a lot of food for thought. Lately, I've had a fascination with analyzing people by the book character they'd correspond in, especially faith faculty to Lord of the Rings characters. Provided the topic isn't too trivial, I'm interested to see if you'd agree with me. And here is the listener's assessment. Charlie is a Brandybuck Hobbit.
Ooh.
Mr. Stearns, Gandalf. Dr. Little. And in parentheses, this one is harder. I'm not as sure. Probably an elf. Rivendell. Dr. Boyd, I heard he'd be on the podcast sometime soon. Hey, Dr. Boyd, if you're listening to this, you were invited to be here today. And I'm just staring over at your microphone. It's just so cold and lonely.
I talked to him this week, and he still calls me the stray cat.
Meow. Anyway. Meow. anyway, he's a Numenorean. Originally, I had him also as an elf. But the Flannery O'Connor fascination didn't quite seem to mesh. Dr. Doug, Bilbo, but able to muster more gravitas when necessary. Hope you found this entertaining, Rachel Franklin. So, what do we think?
Well, I think she got you, a Brandybuck Hobbit.
Yeah.
I disagree.
So, Brandybucks are a little, I don't know. I think more the, like, oh, a little brother. Bit of Frodo.
Because you want Brandybuck? The peace and quiet. What's the Brandybuck component?
Well, okay, what are the wanting peace and tranquility and to sit around and read?
The Brandybucks are like the
it's like Marietta.
Oh, as opposed to the Sackville Bagginses that are trying to
Well, advance no, the Brandybuck side of the family is like the adventurous, you know, more wild, less solitude.
Okay.
Well, you're a mixture of Baggins and Brandybuck.
I think.
What do you think?
I resonate with Hobbit, but I also resonate quite a bit with dwarves.
Oh,
so I'm not sure I would be Gimli, but I like, you know, that a little. He's still got a little adventurous, you know, humor to him, but also you know, quite a little bit different than Hobbit. I don't know. Neither of them are necessarily bookish, but anyway,
I think that's good. I was told personally by Rachel Franklin, shout out for the email, that the reason she thinks I fit with Gandalf, which I thought was very, I was like, oh, Gandalf, cool. I don't know why. And she's like, it's because the way Gandalf interacts with Pippin sometimes reminds me with the way you interact with students in class.
Valid.
Valid. Okay. I'll own that. Tim and Elf, what do you think?
I don't know. Whatever. It's all.
I think we're all.
This is all just games. Like
Elrond. I mean, in the movie.
So, Tim's answer is this is a little too trivial. That's Tim's answer. So I'm going to go through. So
Boyd is a Numenorean. I think
what's
board.
Interesting, probably the closest one is Boyd.
Yeah.
Because we're all human.
Yep.
So we would have, you know, it's interesting. She didn't pick any other humans to be, you know, who were like, but you know, the popular humans in the story. So Boromir, Faramir, you know, Denethor, you know, fill in the blank. And so, I don't think Tim's an elf. I don't know what you think about that.
That's fine. What do you think? I'm
his frustration with Isildur for not getting rid of the ring. I could, you know, I could see a little of that.
But yeah.
I can actually see Gandalf being mad at students also fitting with Tim, but like way, 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 way more.
Yeah. I mean, I could see
he's not like that in real life, people, just on the podcast.
I could see Tim as being like Thranduil, you know, where he's like elf in Mirkwood, where he's just like, doesn't really want to be a part of anything.
Just ready to move on and talk about something more worthwhile.
Dr. Doug, though, we got to tell him that he's Bilbo. That's great.
I say, I don't know about that one either.
It's It's funny though.
Yeah. I mean, I would put, maybe it's because Tim said it in his book. I would look at Doug as more of a Gandalf-y character.
Yeah, I would agree.
But yeah, anyway.
That was fun. Like, I don't think it was too
true. That's like the perspective of us being the hobbits. We're all the hobbits.
Yeah.
And then we've
likened
Doug
ourselves.
Is the sage. Doug is the wise man.
We've likened ourselves to the hobbits as like going on these long journeys of writing and those types of things. And so, Rachel, you should read the Silmarillion and then pick one of the characters out of there first.
There we go. Part two.
Melkor. Anyway.
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books.
I like that. Tim was like, it's time. He's just breaking in.
Tim, you go first.
So I'm going to mention The Unseen Realm, Recovering the Supernatural Worldview of the Bible by Michael Heiser. This is a pretty, this book's made the rounds. It's sold a lot of copies.
I've had a lot of people that I know who have read that and been like, this is great.
Really? Okay.
I'm very curious what you think, because I'm curious myself.
So one thing, let's just start with what the book's about. The book is about recovering the supernatural worldview of the Bible. The author, Michael Heiser, this is kind of like detailing his own personal story. It's written from the first person perspective in a lot of ways. It has a lot of academic credentials to it because he's building off of his doctoral dissertation. So there are a lot of footnotes in the book, but it's really from a first person's perspective when he discovered from Psalm 82 how there are other gods beside the Lord. So who are these other gods? And he didn't realize that. He just figured, well, there's only one God. The Bible says there's only one God. And then he's like, oh, wait a minute. The Bible says there's other gods. So he kind of details how the supernatural worldview of the Bible is more than just the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. There are other deities. Did you not know that? Is that like new information to you, or did you?
So I think like the multiple God view thing, I always thought like when it talks about like Baal and all those, it's like not really gods. They're trying to be in the place of God. And then when it says that thing in the Bible about other gods, I just thought I didn't think that's what it meant, because it must not mean that. It was one of those like presuppositionally, I thought, oh, there's only one God. It must mean something different. Okay. I don't know. I don't think I'd ever thought about it much.
Gotcha. All right. So he kind of talks very sensationally in the book, and that's one of the things I really don't like about it. He begins, we all have watershed moments in life, critical turning points where from that moment on, nothing will ever be the same. And I'm like, really? Is this issue that big of a watershed moment in life? I don't see it's that striking. So he's like, the first verse of Psalm 82, hit me like a bolt of lightning. God, Elohim, stands in the divine assembly. He administers judgment in the midst of the gods. So you have the God judging the gods. And so all of a sudden, he talks about how his understanding and worldview of the Bible is like blown apart. And he details how he goes and looks for answers among conservative evangelicals, and he doesn't find any answers. So then he broadens out and he basically goes to, I mean, not AAR, the American Academy of Religion, but Society of Biblical Literature. So more biblical stuff, but higher critical literature. And then he's discovering all kinds of literature, people talking about the other gods of the Bible. Other gods do exist, okay? We often don't call them gods. What do we normally call them?
Spiritual beings or spiritual beings, demons or
angels, demons. Those are the terms that we often use. So
Balrogs.
You're horrendous.
Not wrong.
So when I say he writes sensationally, here's another illustration. I immediately set to work trying to find answers. I soon discovered that the ground I was exploring was a place where evangelicals had feared to tread. And I'm like, really? This isn't that controversial of an issue. I don't think it's that revolutionary. And I'm like, I think the evangelical world has. Maybe when he was writing and originally doing his research, maybe there wasn't a lot. But he states, I had to look beyond the world of evangelical scholarship. And then he kind of creates this contrast between the traditions in which he had grown up and what the Bible actually had said. So he has a statement here. Was my loyalty to the text or to Christian tradition? And so for me, studying the Old Testament and knowing about other divine beings and gods, you know, Paul even says our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against
spirits and principalities. Yeah, and principalities rulers. And
powers, the rulers of this world. And like, what's he talking about there? Yeah.
Way to go.
Charlie's just dropping all these C.S. Lewis. Well, you should unmute your mic. That's anyway. All right. So
listener Charlie. Well, never mind. We'll let it lie.
So I just want to say, if you read this book or if you've read this book, I would really filter out all of the sensational language. And I don't, this isn't that big of an issue. I don't know how this is such a watershed issue. When you interact with or dealing with, I mean, literally, I went to the American Academy of Religion and I was talking to Doug Brown about it. Okay. This is a spiritual battle. I am in a conference with professors who, when you send your kid to a secular campus, I am interacting with the professors that are deconverting your children, who are arguing for pluralism. And the professors that I am talking to and interacting with, they are ex-evangelicals themselves. Like, they have these faith stories where they've moved from exclusivism. They grew up in a conservative Christian home, and then they realize, oh, wow, there's other faiths out there. Yeah, no kidding. Guess what? Those are other gods, okay? They're other spirit beings. And so the Bible has something to say about that entire conversation. And so anyway, something for you to even think about as you consider taking a religion class at a secular campus, okay? I'm sitting in this conference and they're talking about how can we lead the students so that they have a more inclusivistic approach to religion? You know, what is that? What's that code for? How can we...
Unbelief.
How can we deconvert more kids?
Yep.
You know? And how can we lead them towards unbelief? So anyway, this book, how do I evaluate this? The funny thing is that I actually agree with a lot of what he has to say, but it's not that big of a deal.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
So can I ask a question? Or yeah. I don't want to cut you off.
Go ahead.
But you said he calls it a watershed moment. So if I say watershed, that's like the source of all the following tributaries and springs and all that. And sometimes a watershed moment is like, this is where everything changed and I started to do things differently.
Yeah.
What does his position lead to being different in our theology?
Exactly. And I don't know how his belief in other deities and spirit beings would lead to doing anything differently. And that's where I'm concerned. I haven't gotten to that.
Oh, I see.
Yet.
Okay.
And so I don't have an answer, but I know how some people, it has led them to do things differently. And so in the main content, I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. And it's never good things.
All
right. I'm like, why are we emphasizing the spirit world? Yes, other demons do exist. Do I go to the Buddhist temple and eat the food that they've offered to the Buddha? Well, is the Buddha simply a block of wood or silver or whatever? Yeah, it's just a block of silver. That's all it is. But does it represent something? It does. What does it represent?
Demons.
A demon. Mm-hmm. Okay. So why would I eat food that's been offered to a demon? It's almost like Paul had something to say about that. So how concerned should I be with any of that kind of stuff? So anyway, that's kind of a teaser for our content and the Unseen Realm. Would I recommend this book? I'm going to spend some more time maybe reading it, and maybe I'll give a more of a greater evaluation later. But just be wary of the sensational way of speaking.
All right. So I'm not going to tell you my book yet. So I am actually reading, everybody. I read multiple books this week. Next week, I'll talk about some books. I'm on chapter 4 of Surprised by Oxford. I've read another book multiple days. I'm back. I'm getting there, guys. I'm getting there. But this book, I needed to reference this for a project this week. And I read the introduction. Now, Charlie, listener, you don't know this, but I have a book jacket from a theology book around this one so Tim and Charlie can't see what the book is. Because I want to read the introduction or part of it. Charlie, what?
It's Harry Potter.
He thinks it's Harry Potter.
It's Harry Potter.
He thinks it's Harry Potter.
It's so horrendous.
It's not Harry Potter. Okay. From the foreword. I am not a... What I want you to ask is, does this sound like advice biblically we could give people? Because I think there's some wisdom here, and that's sort of what I want to unpack. I'm not a self-made man. Every time I give a speech at a business conference or speak to college students or do a Reddit AMA, someone says it. There's a bunch of titles for this author, but I'm not going to give them because I give away who it is. As a self-made man, what's your blueprint for success? They are always shocked when I thank them for the compliment, but say, I'm not a self-made man. I got a lot of help. Now, the person who's writing this forward is incredibly successful, but they're not saying that they've done it on their own. They're saying, I needed help from other people. So this person talks about where they grew up. They grew up out of the country and they came to America and they worked really hard, but they didn't know what to do. And they were like trying really hard to figure it out. And they needed to ask people for advice regularly. He says, how can I ever be, and he's already explained all this. He says, how could I ever claim to be a self-made man, to accept that mantle discounts every person and every piece of advice that got me here. And it gives the wrong impression that you can do it alone. I couldn't, and the odds are that you can't either. And so he goes to talk about why this book is going to be helpful. He says, and it's a book about productivity. He says, so whether it's a morning routine or a philosophy or training tip or just motivation to get through your day, there isn't a person on the planet who doesn't benefit from a little outside help. I've always treated the world as my classroom, soaking up lessons and stories to fuel my path forward. I hope you'll do the same. The worst thing that you could ever do is to think that you know enough. Never stop learning, ever. That's why you bought this book. You know that wherever you are in life, there will be moments where you need outside help and motivation and insight. There will be times where you just don't have the answer or the drive and you're forced to look beyond yourself. You can admit that you can't do it alone. I certainly can't. No one can. Now turn the page and start learning something. I read that introduction and I was like surprised because I know who wrote it, but I think we would all say that's good advice. Does that sound proverbial to you?
I mean, there's a humility.
Yeah, humility. I had written down in the margin there, like, there's humility here. Now, listener, what I'm not saying is that you can go to unbelievers and you should whatever. But would it surprise you if I said that was the Governator who wrote that? Arnold Schwarzenegger wrote that. And this is the introduction to Tools of Titans by Tim Ferriss. It's just a book on productivity tips. I was just surprised. I'm not going to say this is why I'm going to be humble and why I'm going to look for advice and wisdom, but I did think it was funny to hear someone who I think is, I wouldn't think they're, that's not how I would describe them. Does that make sense?
You wouldn't think of Arnold Schwarzenegger as being humble?
Well, I mean, I don't know the guy, but I mean, from what I've seen, I'm like, so either he didn't write that or he, in like the way God creates the world, like if you try to do it all on your own, you're going to fail because like you're not finite or you're not infinite, you're finite. So I just thought that was funny. I don't know what to do with that, but I'm like, oh, that'd be interesting to, I'm not going to go to this and be like, oh, now the Bible's true because Schwarzenegger said so. But it is interesting that like even people trying so hard, you can't escape how God's made us and how the world is. I think that's where I'm going with it, Tim.
Yeah, it's like the common grace of God.
Yeah, that's what I, yeah.
As you live in this world, you can see how things work, mm-hmm. and then you can grow in yep. wisdom, even yeah. as an individual who doesn't believe, they don't have faith.
Yeah. So I just thought that was an interesting little tidbit. I'm like, oh, I'll share this. Charlie's just, he's over there moping that it's not Harry Potter. And
Blind squirrel finds a nut every now and then. That applies in multiple ways.
So anyways, no recommendation for the book. It's just, I needed it for a project. I just thought that was an interesting little tidbit to bat around.
All right. Business that is accompanied by a book. It's turkey season.
I am so excited about this.
And so friend of the pod. Well, he's not truly a friend of the podcast. He's never been on the podcast. Maybe someday.
Meat's back on the menu, boys.
That's right. So Sawyer Gogarty was with me. And so this book, it's The Hive of the Bee Hunter, a repository of sketches, including Peculiar American Character by Thomas Bangs Thorpe. And he's like a reporter or an author in like the 1800s. And he's from New York, and he would go to the South and the West, which at that time is like, you know, Tennessee, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi. And he's like writing stories for people back in New York because they're like wanting to know about this like frontier. So he's got all these stories about, I just read the one, you know, about this bee hunter where he goes and finds the bees. He chops their tree down to get their honey. Like, and it's in one sense, it is reporting. Like he's telling real stories, but it is very like mythical where it's like he's, I think, a very accomplished, precise writer with what he does imaginatively to get someone in New York to understand what's going on in the middle of a bear hunt or, you know, in this case, turkey hunting. So the very first, you know, sketch is wild turkey hunting, which I've already mentioned on this podcast before, but I've read through this and what it does so interestingly is it paints the picture of the hunt from within the mind of the turkey. So it's like, imagine you're the turkey and you're going to get killed, but like playing it out from that imaginative standpoint. This is so great. And I
love this so much.
So here, I picked up Sawyer at 3 a.m. the other day, because you have to get there before they wake up. And I have this book and I was like, Sawyer, you have required reading. Before we get there, you have to read this and you have to do it out loud.
Teachers never stop teaching.
And well, what's great is, you know, Sawyer and I are very kindred. And at first you could tell he's like, it's 3 a.m. I'm not, you know, but he started reading it. And there was a moment probably one of my favorite moments of this hunt is he's a couple pages into this and he's like, okay, yeah, this is great.
That's awesome.
And just, but so I want to just read a little bit of this depiction. And so he describes wild turkeys. He describes the people that hunt them. And I've already quoted this before that he paints a picture of a hunter, not as like a brute, but like a philosopher. Like he likes the solitude. He likes to be out there and pondering things. And even if he doesn't kill or find his game, he still gets some time to think, which is still very valuable. He mentions the hunter as a reader, as a philosophizer, and which is not how we depict a hunter like today. And so, and as Sawyer lamented, most of the people that are into hunting in Iowa are just hicks and they have mullets. And that's not the picture. That's not the picture that Thomas Bangs Thorpe paints here. So just listen to this paragraph. Okay. And this gobbler is out there. He's been feeding and this hunter is just very quietly giving out these very single calls, like these clucks, trying to lure the turkey in. And listen to this paragraph. Like the slipper of Cinderella to the imagination of the young prince, or the glimpses of a waving ringlet or jeweled hand to the glowing passions of a young heart, is the remembrance of that sound that now full 2 hours since was first heard by our hero and has been in that long time but twice repeated. He speculates that in the shady woods that surround him there must wander a mate. Solitarily she plucks her food and calls for me. The monster man, impatient of his prey, doles not out his music so softly or so daintily. I am not deceived, and by my ungulant fears, she will be won by another. So this turkey is like, oh, you know, I'm afraid there's a human over there. But no, like that girl over there is calling for me. And it's like finding the slipper of Cinderella. And he's like, you know, if I don't act on this, she's going to be won by another man. And it's this slow enticing of this turkey. And I'm just going to read a little bit more here. I posted this on my Facebook and Instagram the other day.
It was beautiful.
The noble bird, now certain of success, he's going to find and woo this hen. Certain of success, fairly dances with delight. He starts forward, his feathers and neck amorously playing as he advances. Now he commences his strut. His slender body swells. The beautiful plumage of his breast unfolds itself. His neck curves, drawing the neck down. The wattles grow scarlet, while the skin that covers the head changes like rainbow tints. The long feathers of the wings brush the ground. The tail rises and opens into a semicircle. The gorgeously colored head becomes beautifully relieved in its center. On he comes with a hitching gait, glowing in the sunshine with purple and gold. And so it's just this beautiful picture of a turkey hunt from the perspective of the turkey. And so the full story there, Sawyer reads that. We go in and we commence our business with our book. And this exactly happens. A bird flies out in the field and we watched him slowly strut in over probably an hour.
Wow.
Until he got about, 5-10 yards from us, and we killed it, took it home with us, and it was just a beautiful thing. And so, yeah, it's books, Thomas Bangs Thorpe, and business. I got a turkey in my fridge. So there we go.
Dude, that's awesome.
Books and business.
That quote when you posted, I'd remembered it from the episode, and I was like, oh, this is great.
And so what's funny is Sawyer saw that, and he went out hunting on Sunday afternoon. And he had purpose that if he was to kill a turkey, he was going to post a picture and put the exact same quote.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like we're the same thing. And I won't tell the story because it's not my story to tell. But he had an interchange with the glorious bird, and no post was made. So you can you can ask Sawyer what happened.
No post was made.
Anyway.
Let's have a conversation about the gods. So in The Unseen Realm, Heiser talks about how Psalm 82 is a watershed moment. So I want to basically work through Old Testament theology, really it's a biblical theology, but I'm going to be focusing on the Old Testament, of what it means when it says a god or gods. The definition of Heiser has some merits, but then we're going to culminate in Psalm 82, and we're going to then take that biblical theology and explain what the gods are in Psalm 82. We will then end with some application as well. So the word God, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, okay, starts right at the very beginning. Okay, the word that's used there is a plural. So it's technically, in the beginning, gods created the heavens and the earth. Now, this is well known within Hebrew studies. It is a plural. The verb itself, however, is a singular. So, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. Bara is a singular. So this is a grammatical error. Just like in English, if you have a plural noun, you would use a plural verb. So for example, they is a good group of kids. Okay. So you wouldn't say they is, you would say they are. Okay. That is essentially what you get in the Hebrew Bible all the time. So there's always a question whenever you run into the word Elohim as a plural. Well, is it referring to the one true God, or is it referring to the gods? And you can tell whether or not it's God singular or gods plural, usually, not always, but usually, because of the verb. If it's referring to the gods plural, then what kind of a verb do you get? A plural verb. If it's talking about the one true God, it's a singular verb. So when we think through gods in the Bible, where do we see gods showing up? Well, it's actually a broader category than we might think. We see this even in the New Testament, by the way. Jesus kind of pokes at the Pharisees a little bit with it because they're like making accusations about him. And anyway, so this might be even something for you guys. Where do we see gods in the Bible? Do you guys know? I don't know how familiar you are with this conversation.
No, I mean, other than in Egypt and...
Sure, so I mean, just the other deities.
Yeah, but I don't know. Well, in the New Testament, Jesus used it as a defensive tactic once.
Yeah.
But I, yeah.
which he kind of creates, Jesus kind of creates confusion with it just to kind of goad them. It's kind of funny, but anyway, so like in, this is a prevalent theme in the Old Testament, and that's where Heiser is correct. Like he'll list a whole pile of different passages where this is a prevalent thing.
Well, my mind pops to, you know, you shall have no other gods before me.
Yeah. And I have this one, author that mentions that verse specifically, because what does that verse then imply?
That there are other gods.
Precisely. Here's the quote. Even the first of the Ten Commandments point to the presence of other gods. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. That God admitting to other gods and saying, in effect, sure, other gods exist. Just be sure to choose me over them. So that's from Eve Isn't Evil by Julie Faith Parker. So she makes that point, which we'll come back to that book. Okay, so as we think through the gods, we have in Psalm 89, the heavens will praise your wonders, O Lord, your faithfulness also in the assembly of the saints. For who in the heavens can be compared to the Lord? Who among the sons of the mighty can be likened to the Lord? I think I'm using the NKJV here. But in that verse where it says, who among the sons of the mighty? Okay, this is the sons of the gods can be likened to the Lord. There's a comparison that's being made. But what is the text communicating about the Lord and his relationship to the other gods?
He's like way over them.
He's way over them. It's like they don't exist. Okay. Psalm 29 and verse 1, give unto the Lord, O you mighty ones, give unto the Lord glory and strength. Give unto the Lord the glory due to his name. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. So where is the sons of God here? Well, in Psalm 29, verse 1. Give unto the Lord, O you mighty ones. What are mighty ones? That's how actually the KJV and NKJV translate sons of God, which is part of Heiser's issue. He doesn't like that translation because it's referring to presumably other spirit beings.
What's the word there?
I don't have the Hebrew right here. I can look it up.
So my mind thinks like Giborim or something like that.
What's that?
Like Gibor?
It's not Gibor. That's the thing. When you see mighty one, it's often a reference to the mighty warrior.
Yeah, that's what like, popped into my mind.
Like Gabriel is Gavar.
The mighty one of God.
The mighty one of God, precisely.
The mighty one of El.
Of El. Mm-hmm. And so in Psalm 29:1, it is, you know, Bnei Elohim. It's the sons of God. So give unto the Lord, O sons of God, give unto the Lord glory and strength.
Did the NKJV do that to not sound like it was pluralistic or whatever? Or like, did they?
Why pantheist they, or not pantheist? Or polytheist.
Polytheist. That's what I was thinking. Is that, do you think, why they made that decision? Or
yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay. That's
I am quoting the NKJV there. I just checked.
So it's funny, ESV, just, I don't know if this derails you, but I went to look the word up too and had the ESV up and it says, ascribe to the Lord, O heavenly beings.
Right.
So it even is using a different word for these since they're not God. That's interesting.
Because it's sons of God. And who are the sons of God?
Heavenly beings.
Heavenly beings. Are the sons of God heavenly beings? Yeah, I believe they are. And Heiser makes that case. This wasn't new information to me. I'm just like, well, yeah, of course they are. You have in Job 39, you know, I didn't even put that one in my list here, but Job I think it's 39. It's one of the key texts that the sons of God are heavenly beings is there in Job, where the sons of the morning stars are glorifying the Lord. And so what are the morning stars? Well, what does that metaphor mean, morning star? What is a morning star?
I always thought that was like code for angels or something.
Yeah, it is. It's a code for an angel. And so the stars are like angelic beings. There's a correlation in the ancient Near Eastern world between stars and angels. There's a whole conversation about, you know, the angel that visited, or no, the star that showed the wise men the birthplace.
No
way. Oh yeah, where there's some people who say it's not a star, it's an angel that's pointing them the way.
Which, you know, inter-medieval cosmology of Lewis and his friends, like, this is what they
exactly,
I think, actually believed.
Right.
Like, Venus is an angel on a planet, you know.
And represents, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Morning Star is referred to in Isaiah 14. It's my dissertation text. You know, if you really want to get into it, I have a book called Israel's Eschatological Enemy. Mm. You can pick that up. And I work through the Morning Star metaphor. But the issue, the metaphor, is that Heiser actually takes a different view on the metaphor. There's a discussion on what a star means. At first, it's an angelic being, yes, but it's also somebody who is a king, for example, who is the morning star. Does it sound like a metaphor referring to somebody whom we actually will worship and should worship today? Okay, Jesus is the morning star. And what is the morning star? Well, it is the brightest star in the night sky, which, by the way, what is the morning star?
Polaris or no. The North Star?
No,
or?
It's not a star. It's a planet. Is it? It's Venus.
That's very Paralandrous.
I told you Paralandra is like my favorite of the trilogy. And it gets even to this discussion with Psalm 82, because there are correspondences in Paralandra with the character Weston and the demonic influence upon him. It's very parallel to exactly what Heiser is talking about in the unseen realm. Okay, and this whole idea of the spirit being influencing an individual. Okay, so this is kind of the conversation. How are we doing? Are we okay?
Very good. I'm taking notes even.
So I do have one passage in Job. Job 1 is a big text in this whole conversation. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan also came among them. Okay, so you have sons of God being accompanied by Satan. Well, who is Satan? Who are the sons of God?
Demons.
Demons, heavenly beings, okay? Spirit beings, maybe not heavenly beings. Okay.
Ex-heavenly beings.
Ex-heavenly beings. Speaking of ex-evangelicals. ex-out-of-heaven-ish people, whatever, spirit beings. So this is not something that's new or foreign to Old Testament theology. So if you thought, there is only one God, the God of gods, when we say that there's only one God, we're not denying the existence of other spirit beings who can acquire the title of God. Certainly, there are other spirit beings that exist. But as far as a Christian is concerned, guess what? There's one that matters. And the rest of them, they don't matter. You need to focus on your worship to the one true God and get to know him. Be careful wanting to get to know other spirit beings. All right, so Deuteronomy 32:17, I think, sheds some light on this whole spirit beings thing. It states, they sacrificed to demons, not to God. To gods they did not know. To new gods, new arrivals that your fathers did not fear. Okay, what's the correlation that Deuteronomy 32:17 is making? The parallelism is obvious. They sacrificed to demons. And then what does the next line say? To gods. They did not know. So what is a definition of a god? I'm essentially, and Heiser does this, and I think he's appropriate to do so, broadening your definition of a god. A god is partly a spirit being. A demon is a kind of a god. How are we doing? So in Genesis 1:26, this is some people really get hung up in Genesis 1:26 and in Genesis 11, where it says, let us go down and confuse their language. Who is God talking to when he says, you know, it's, the Lord said, let us go down and confuse their language? And people get really worked up about this, but if you just think through, there's the Lord, and there are other spirit beings, and Satan, along with other spirit beings, have access to the throne room of God and can make requests or can carry out God's petitions, okay, then it's not that confusing. When the Lord says, by the way, it's the Lord, his personal divine name, and it's a singular verb. So the Lord, singular, said, let us, plural, go down and confuse their languages. Well, how does God effect that? By allowing other spirit beings by giving them permission to effect his will. Like, that sounds kind of weird, I'm like, well, that's the way that things work. And we see it repeatedly in the Old Testament. God often gives people what they desire. And if they want something that is not good or unwholesome for them, God sometimes doesn't give them to it, but sometimes he does. And then what do they then receive? Something unwholesome, something not good for themselves. Do you guys know of maybe a story of some king that wanted to do something, like go to war? And God said, fine, you want to go to war? Then I'll help you go to war, and there you'll die. So in 1 Kings 22, you have the story of Micaiah. He was a prophet in the northern kingdom. He was one of Ahaz's prophets. And Micaiah, Ahaz wants to go to war. Ahaz wants to go to war, and he's going to go to war with Jehoshaphat. And so they bring the prophets in, and all the prophets are like, go to war. You're going to beat the king of Syria. And then Jehoshaphat's there, and he's like, are there any prophets of the Lord here? Which is saying something about Ahaz's prophets. Guess what they were? Not prophets of the Lord. And so he's like, well, I've got this one guy, but I don't like him because he never prophesies anything good about me. And Jehoshaphat's like, let not the king say such a thing. I'm paraphrasing the story here. And so let's get this guy. So they go and they get Micaiah. And Micaiah comes out and he says, go to war. The Lord is going to prosper your hand. I'm paraphrasing, okay? But Micaiah's sarcasm must have been super thick because Ahab is like, didn't I tell you to always speak the truth in the name of the Lord? And so then Micaiah responds with this. Then Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing by on his right hand and on his left. Okay, you have a throne room. You have a host of heaven, right hand and left. They're all around. And the Lord said, who will persuade Ahab to go up that he may fall at Ramoth Gilead? So one spoke in this manner and another spoke in that manner. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said to him, in what way? So he said, I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. And the Lord said, you shall persuade him and also prevail. Go out and do so. Therefore, look, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these prophets of yours, and the Lord has declared disaster against you. And so Ahaz believes his prophets, which is kind of funny because he goes into that battle in camouflage. Okay, he doesn't go as the actual king. He goes just as a, I don't know, like not as a king in his royal garments, and a random arrow strikes him and kills him. So it's like he takes Micaiah's advice seriously, but God still affects his will and destroys him. Anyway, that's kind of aside from the point here. The point being is, what is there?
There are other gods, but it doesn't mean, it's like there are other spiritual beings.
There are other spiritual beings.
Yeah.
Which does not shake our theology. It's not a watershed moment in our understanding of theology. Paul says that our battle is not against flesh and blood. And so when you are going to a secular campus and you are putting yourself under the tutelage of a ex-evangelical who's abandoned the faith and is there to persuade you away from the faith, it is a spiritual battle, and you're subjecting yourself to what? A spirit influence that is an authority over you. Okay, you think about that and where maybe you should go to school this fall, or, you know, you process through where maybe you should be sending your kid, your child in that kind of a setting. So let's see here. So what do we have? I have a lot of different passages here. Oh, there's one other thing. Everybody talks about the divine counsel. I don't like the word counsel, because what does divine counsel conjure up? What is that idea?
It's like you got to take a poll and get some wisdom.
Yeah, I'm going to gain some wisdom
from these. When I get counsel, I go to ask you for advice. I ask Charlie for advice. Right. I'm getting counsel.
And so when you read through 1 Kings 22, it sounds like God is asking for advice on how to persuade Ahab. God's not asking for advice, okay? There is a measure of metaphor, okay? I mean, did that scene ever really happen with Micaiah? Or is Micaiah just kind of giving an analogy of how God is destroying going to destroy you and using a lying spirit. Yeah, maybe that actual scene transpired, but it's reflective of the ancient worldview where you have the Lord and other spirit beings which do God's bidding. Okay, don't read into that story, oh, God's looking for advice from these other. God can't learn anything because he already knows everything. So it's not a council. It's more of a throne room where you have God, and then he uses other spirit beings to affect his will by allowing them to do certain things. God is still sovereign and in control. Okay, so like Satan makes accusations before the Lord in Zechariah chapter 3. Satan is cast out from heaven in Revelation chapter 12. People are like, oh, Satan's not, doesn't have access to the throne room of God anymore. I'm like, no, I think he still does. In Revelation 12, 7 through 9, war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So this is an eschatological, well, future to us. It's future to us text. So if Satan and his angels do not have a place in heaven any longer, what does that imply? They still have access to the throne room of God at this time. This gets into the sons of God passage in Genesis 6, which people get all worked about, but it states the sons of God in Genesis chapter 6. Well, what are the sons of God from an Old Testament theological perspective? They are
spiritual beings.
Spiritual beings. Okay. So you can read the three different views and we can split churches over that. It's not that big of a deal. Okay, I'm being sarcastic there. But I believe they're spiritual beings, and you have a lot of, I think, Old Testament theology that supports that. Okay, now I'm going to transition a little bit here. Gods are spirit beings, but can gods be human? Exodus chapter 4. Verses 16 and 17. So he said, or so he shall be your spokesman to the people. That's Aaron. God is speaking here. So Aaron will be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God. What is going on in Exodus 4? God, the Lord God, is creating an analogy. Moses is God to Pharaoh, and Aaron is his prophet. God uses this as an analogy, and we see this repeatedly in the Old Testament. When we think of gods, we think of the spirit entity, but it's more than that. Humans can be gods. Almost like the tree of the knowledge of fruit and evil. goodness. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Satan, and when the serpent tempts, you know, you shall be like gods, knowing good and evil. Okay, are you kind of seeing here a little bit? Our definition of God is much more specific than an Old Testament theology's definition of God. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, I'm going to read verses 15 through 18. So I took the heads of your tribes, wise and knowledgeable men, and made them heads over you, leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, leaders of tens, and officers for your tribes. Then I commanded your judges at that time, saying, okay, so he's commanding the judges, hear the cases between your brethren, and judge righteously between a man and his brother or the stranger who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid in any man's presence, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too hard for you, bring to me and I will hear it. So throughout the Old Testament worldview, who are gods? Well, judges are gods. Because what are they supposed to do? They're deciding for people what is right and wrong. Ah, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So a judge is judging for God. So in the Old Testament, who else are gods? Judges. Not only judges, but also kings. You already saw that implied with Moses. Moses is not a king, but he is functioning like a king for the children of Israel. You're like, okay, where do you see that kings are gods? Okay, controversial passage, Psalm 45. My heart is overflowing with a good theme. I recite my composition concerning the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. Psalm 45, verse 2. You are fairer than the sons of men. Grace is poured upon your lips. Therefore, God has blessed you forever. Okay, so who is the king in Psalm 45? And there's some controversy and discussion about this because it sounds very messianic. In fact, we get the word anointed in the text itself, but the individual here seems earthly. States in Psalm 45, verse 3, gird your sword upon your thigh, O mighty one, with your glory and your majesty. The picture here is of a king with a sword on his thigh. It is his wedding day, and he is an instrument of righteousness and justice for the people, i.e., he is a god. Verse 4, and in your majesty, ride prosperously because of truth, humility, and righteousness, and your right hand shall teach you awesome things. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The peoples fall under you. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of your kingdom. And this is the reference that people get all worked up about, because who is the God in Psalm 45 and verse 6? It seems like, oh, is that, no, I thought we were talking about an earthly king. Then it states in verse 7, you love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness more than your companions. So how can your God anoint you as a God? And the answer is that because he is a God, he's a king. And a king is a god. This is where people are like, well, this must refer to Jesus. Well, it kind of falls apart pretty quickly, especially in the following verses where he's a very earthly individual. In verse 9, king's daughters are among your honorable women. Yeah, that applies really well to Jesus. And that he's married. That doesn't kind of work theologically. Okay, so Psalm 45 is in reference to an earthly king who has been anointed by the Lord as the king. Well, he is a God in that he is functioning as the arbiter of righteousness and justice for God over the people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I'm following you.
All right, I got to wrap this up because it's going kind of long. Now, what about the power behind a king? Or the power behind a judge? Is there a spiritual presence, a spiritual being that might influence particularly people in positions of power and authority? Obvious answer is yes. Where do we see that? Isaiah 14. Who is the power that empowers the king of Babylon or the Antichrist? Okay, Satan himself. He is the spirit being that empowers him. And this is where I like Paralandra, because in Paralandra, the character of Weston, I mean, Lewis has this one quote where he's like, am I talking to Weston or am I talking to the spirit being behind him? And it's just like, he makes a statement how, well, really, is there a difference? Because the spirit being is the person and the person has become the spirit being. And that's essentially what you get in Isaiah 14, where the king of Babylon, the Antichrist, is the one who is punished. But is there a spiritual being that is influencing him and guiding and directing? Of course. Okay. But as a person, guess what happens to the king himself? He is punished because he did the deeds. And the punishment is leveled against the individual that's done the deeds. Okay, now let's go to Psalm 82 and let's bring this thing around. So Psalm 82 was his watershed moment. God stands in the congregation of the mighty. He judges among the gods. Who are the gods? Well, what does it say in verse 2? How long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? What does that sound like?
That sounds like what the judges of the kings have been doing this whole time. So, okay, now it's all starting to come together. Tie this up for us. I think it's
you see it now?
This is starting to make sense.
This passage is talking about God's judgment of the judges, the human judges, and how they have judged unjustly. Is there a spiritual presence behind them? Yes. Who gets the penalty, even if they were succumbing or listening to the spiritual presence behind them? The judge themselves. They're judged. What does it state then in Psalm 82 and verse 3? Defend the poor and fatherless. Do justice to the afflicted and needy. Deliver the poor and needy. Free them from the hand of the wicked. This is an exhortation to judges to judge judiciously. It's not some spirit being thing. So Psalm 82 verse 5, they do not know, nor do they understand. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are unstable. What makes the foundations of the earth unstable? When judges do not judge judiciously, okay? The world starts to fall apart. Verse 6, I said, you are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High. But you shall die like men. I'm like, this is not a reference, one of those references to divine beings. This is a psalm of judgment to judges and encouraging them to judge justly. And if they think that they are gods and they'll be able to do whatever they want and they're not going to be held in account by anybody, they're wrong. Guess what? Somebody is going to hold them accountable. The God of gods is going to hold them accountable. You shall die like men and fall like one of the princes. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all of the nations. And that's the end of the psalm. That's it. It's 8 verses. It's that short. So is this some watershed moment? This isn't some watershed. This isn't that big of a deal, but maybe, you know, you're a listener and you just don't really understand the spirit, everything that's going on in this world. And I would encourage you, that's okay. It's not that big of a deal. Okay. You don't need to know all of this stuff. In fact, doesn't Paul say something about not looking into the spiritual world and things that are going on? Exactly. All right. So, you know, Julie Faith Parker, her book, Eve Isn't Evil. Well, where can this go? Where can this go awry? Well, first of all, you start seeing, oh, there are other spirit beings. Well, maybe I should pray to them. No, you pray to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. All right. Oh, well, there's a spirit being that might be able to help me. That's Isaiah 8. And what does God have to say about it in Isaiah 8? No. If God is not answering your prayer, trust him and move forward. Do not go looking for additional information. Please don't. Just be content with the revelation that God has given you. God has revealed his will through his word. Go to his word. And if you can't figure it out, and trust other counselors and then walk in faith. That might feel like you're walking in darkness. Just trust him, do his will, obey. Don't go looking for other information. Okay, I have a family member, my sister, and she's charismatic, and she's talking about how the Holy Spirit's speaking to her. And I don't know what the world I probably should have asked more questions. Let me just tell you that it wasn't the Holy Spirit, okay? And she was receiving revelation, okay? She was a spirit being that identified as the Holy Spirit, was speaking to her, I learned later on, okay? And it was not the Holy Spirit. This is not something to mess around with or to trifle with. So be content with the revelation that God has given you. Pray only to the Lord. Listen only to the Lord, which is his word, and make sure you submit to godly leadership and your pastor in a non-charismatic church, okay? And submit to that leadership and then walk in faith. I pray that you would walk in wisdom concerning the gods of this world, and that you would truly worship the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the God of Gods. He is the only one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.